reading some poems from my first book, which I published a few years ago. The first poem is called The Wound. This is a figurative wound with figurative consequences. But saying this is a figurative wound with figurative consequences, but it is about, I think, the fifth line of the poem gives a key to what it is symbolic of. It's reason being separated from the will. Rather, it's will alone without reason. The wound. The huge wound in my head began to heal about the beginning of the seventh week. Its valleys darkened, its villages became still. Waiting, I did not move and dared not speak. So reason might again be joined to will. But constantly my mind returned to Troy. After I sailed the seas, I fought in turn on both sides, sharing even Helen's joy of place, and growing up to see Troy burn as Neoptolemus, that stubborn boy. I lay and rested as prescription said, maneuvered with the Greeks or sallied out each day with Hector. Finally, my bed became Achilles' tent, to which the lout Thersites came reporting numbers dead. I was myself, subject to no man's breath. My own commander was my enemy. And while my belt hung up, sword in the sheath, Thersites shambled in and breathlessly cackled about my friend Patroclus' death. I called for armor, rose, and did not reel. But when I thought, rage at his noble pain flew to my head, and turning, I could feel my wound break open wide. Over again, I had to let those storm-lit valleys heal. The next poem is called Incident on a Journey. There are two characters in this, one being the narrator, and the other, person, the ghost he is speaking to. This is a highly romantic poem, but I still like it. Incident on a Journey. One night I reached a cave. I slept, my head full of the air. There came about daybreak a red-coat soldier to the mouth who said, I am not living. In hell's pains I ache, but I regret nothing. His forehead had a bloody wound whose streaming the pallid staring face illuminated. Whether his words were mine or his, in dreaming I found they were my deepest thoughts translated. I regret nothing. Turn your closed eyes to see upon these walls a mural scratched there by an earlier man and colored with the blood of animals, showing humanity beyond its span, regretting nothing. No plausible nostalgia, no brown shame I had when treating with my enemies, and always when a living impulse came, I acted, and my action made me wise, and I regretted nothing. I, as possessor of unnatural strength, was hunted, one day netted in a brawl, a minute far beyond a minute's length, took from me passion, strength, and life, and all, but I regretted nothing. There triumph left my body in the dust and beer still clotting in my hair when I rise lonely, willless. Where I must, I go, and what I must, I bear, and I regret nothing. My lust runs yet and is unsatisfied. My hate throbs yet, but I am feeble-limbed. If as an animal I could have died, my death had scattered instinct to the wind, regrets as nothing. Later I woke. I started to my feet. The valley light, the mist already going. I was alive and felt my body sweet, uncaked blood in all its channels flowing. I would regret nothing. Next, I would like to read a love poem called For a Birthday. For a Birthday, or Birthday Poem, is always a convenient title, I found, to give to a poem when one doesn't know what to call it otherwise. For a Birthday. I have reached a time when words no longer help. Instead of guiding me across the moors, strong landmarks in the uncertain out of doors, or like dependable friars on the Alp, saving with wisdom and with brandy kegs, their gravel stones, or tiny dogs which yelp, biting my trousers, running round my legs. Description and analysis degrade, limit, delay, slipped land from what has been. And when we groan, my darling, what we mean, looked at more closely, would too soon evade the intellectual habit of our eyes, and either the experience would fade, or our approximations would be lies. The snarling dogs, I wait upon my haste, tons which I am detaching, ounce by ounce. All my agnostic irony I renounce, so I may climb to regions where I rest, in springs of speech, the dark before of truth. The sweet, moist wafer of your tongue I taste, and find right meanings in your silent mouth. And I'd like to finish up a group of these early poems. Perhaps it's rather pretentious saying early poems at this age, but this is another love poem called La Prisonnière, which is not only the French for the prisoner, but the title of part of Proust's novel. La Prisonnière. Now I will shut you in a box with massive sides and a lid that locks. Only by that I can be sure that you are still mine and mine secure, and know where you are when I'm not by, no longer needing to wander and spy. I may forget you at party or play, but do not fear I shall keep away with any Miss Brown or any Miss Jones. If my return finds a heap of bones, too dry to simper, too dry to whine, you will still be mine, and only mine. I'd now like to read a rather longer poem called On the Move, which was written in California about 3 years ago. It's about motorcyclists, but the motorcyclists don't arrive in the poem until the second stanza. It starts, along beside El Camino, I suppose.
The blue jay scuffling in the bushes follows some hidden purpose, and the gust of birds that spurts across the field, the wheeling swallows, have nested in the trees and undergrowth, seeking their instinct or their poise or both. One moves with an uncertain violence under the dust thrown by a baffled sense or the dull thunder of approximate words. On motorcycles up the road they come, small, black as flies hanging in heat, the boys, until the distance throws them forth. Their hum bulges to thunder held by calf and thigh. In goggles, donned in personality, in gleaming jackets, trophied with the dust, they strap in doubt by hiding it robust, and almost hear a meaning in their noise. Exact conclusion of their hardiness has no shape yet, but from known whereabouts they ride, direction where the tires press. They scare a flight of birds across the field, much that is natural to the will must yield. Men manufacture both machine and soul, and use what they imperfectly control to dare a future from the taken roots. It is a part solution, after all. One is not necessarily discord on earth, or damned because, half animal, one lacks direct instinct, because one wakes afloat on movement that divides and breaks. One joins the movement in a valueless world, choosing it till, both hurler and the hurled, one moves as well, always toward, toward. A minute holds them who have come to go. The self-defined, astride the created will, they burst away. The towns they travel through are home for neither bird nor holiness, for birds and saints complete their purposes. At worst, one is in motion, and at best, reaching no absolute in which to rest, one is always nearer by not keeping still. Next, a rather different poem called Autumn Chapter in a Novel. I call it this because it's a sort of combination of the situation in Stendhal's novel, The Red and the Black, and of the emotion in Flaubert's novel, Sentimental Education, which are both novels I admire very much. It doesn't come from either specifically, I suppose. Autumn Chapter in a Novel. Through woods, Madame Intel, a trifle ill with idleness, but no less beautiful, walks with a young tutor. Round their feet, mob syllables slurred to a fine complaint, which in their time held off the natural heat. The sun is distant, and they fill out space, sweatless as watercolor under glass. He kicks abruptly, but we may suppose the leaves he scatters thus will settle back in much the same position as they rose. A tutor's indignation works on air, altering nothing. Action bustles where, towards the pool by which they lately stood, the husband comes discussing with his bailiff poachers, the broken fences round the wood. Pighead, the poacher, is at large and lingers, a dead mouse gripped between his sensitive fingers. Fences already keep the live game out. See how your property twists her parasol, hesitates in the tender trap of doubt. Here they repair, here daily handle lightly the brief excitements that disturb them nightly. Sap draws back inch by inch, and to the ground the words they uttered rustle constantly. Silent, they watch the growing, weightless mound. They leave at last a chosen element, resume the motions of their discontent. She takes her sewing up, and he again names to her son the deserts on the globe, and leaves thrust violently upon the pane. The last word of that poem, pane, is a window pane. It's not P-A-I-N. Sometimes people have been confused, I've found. The next poem is called The Silver Age. I use the word moonlight. I use moonlight here as a sort of symbol of sterility, lack of vigor that apparently one hears was one of the characteristics of the Silver Age in Rome. The Silver Age. Do not inquire from the centurion nodding at the corner, with his head gentle over the swelling breastplate, where true Rome is found. Even of Livy there are volumes lost. All he can do is guide you through the moonlight. When he moves, mark how his eager striding, to which we know the darkness is a river sullen with mud, is easy as on ground. We know it is a river never crossed by any but some few who hate the moonlight. And when he speaks, mark how his ancient wording is hard with indignation of a lover. I do not think our new emperor likes the sound of turning squadrons or the last post, consorts with Christians. I think he lives in moonlight. Hurrying to show you his companions guarding, he grips your arm like a cold strap of leather, then halts, earth pale, as he stares round and round. What made this one fragment of a sunken coast remain far out to be beaten by the moonlight? The unsettled motorcyclist's vision of his death. Most of this takes place underground, as you'll see. Across the open countryside, into the walls of rain I ride. It beats my cheek, drenches my knees, but I am being what I please. The firm heath stops, and marsh begins. Now we're at war. Whichever wins, my human will cannot submit to nature, though brought out of it. The wheels sink deep, the clear sound blows. Still, bent on the handlebars, I urge my chosen instrument against the mere embodiment. The front wheel wedges fast between two shrubs of glazed insensate green, gigantic order in the rim of each flat leaf, black eddies brim around my heel, which, pressing deep, accelerates the waiting sleep. I used to live in sound and lacked knowledge of still or creeping fact, but now the stagnance strips my breath, lent on my cheek in weight of death. Though so oppressed, I find I may through substance move. I pick my way where death and life in one combine, through the dark earth that is not mine, crowded with fragments, blunt, unformed, while past my ear where noises swarmed, the marsh plant's white extremities, slow without patience, spread at ease, invulnerable and soft, extend with a quiet grasping toward their end. And though the tubers, once I rot, reflesh my bones with pallid knot, till swelling out my clothes they feign this dummy is a man again, it is as servants they insist, without volition that they twist, and habit does not leave them tired, by men laboriously acquired. Cell after cell the plants convert my special richness in the dirt. All that they get by chance, and multiply in ignorance. I'm anti-plant. This next poem is called Elvis Presley. It's not, people always laugh, but it's not ironical, it's pretty serious. 2 minutes long, it pitches through some bar. Unreeling from a corner box, the sigh of this one in his gangling finery and crawling sideburns, wielding a guitar. The limitations where he found success are ground on which he, panting, stretches out in turn, promiscuously, by every note, our idiosyncrasy and our likeness. We keep ourselves in touch with a mere dime, distorting hackneyed words in hackneyed songs. He turns revolt into a style, prolongs the impulse to a habit of the time. Whether he poses or is real, no cat bothers to say. The pose held is a stance, which, generation of the very chance it was on, may be posture for combat. And next, what I suppose you could call a regional poem. It's not in dialect. Called Market at Turk. It's this region. At the street corner, hunched up, he gestates action, prepared for some unique combat in boots, jeans, and a curious cap whose very peak jammed forward indicates resolution. It is military, almost, how he buckles himself in with bootstraps and marine belt, reminders of the will, lest even with that hard discipline the hardness should not be felt. He waits, whom no door snatches, to unbuckling in the close commotion of bar or bed. He presides in apartness, not yet knowing his purpose fully, and fingers the blade. His next poem is called In Praise of Cities. It's not especially about San Francisco. There's reference to Charing Cross Road, which is a road in London, and 42nd Street, by which I mean 42nd Street in New York. In praise of cities, indifferent to the indifference that conceived her, grown buxom in disorder now, she accepts, like dirt, strangers, or moss upon her churches, your tribute to the wharf of circumstance, rejected side street, formal monument, and, irresistible, the thoroughfare. You welcome in her what remains of you, and what is strange and what is incomplete compels a passion without understanding for all you cannot be. Only at dawn you might escape. She sleeps then for an hour. Watch where she hardly breathes, spread out and cool, her pavements desolate in the dim dry air. You stay, yet she is occupied, apart. Out of a mist the river turns to see whether you follow still. You stay. At evening your blood gains pace, even as her blood does. Casual, yet urgent in her lovemaking, she constantly asserts her independence, suddenly turning moist pale walls upon you, your own designs peeling and unachieved, or her whole darkness hunching in an alley. And all at once you enter the embrace withheld by day while you solicited. She wanders lewdly, whispering her given name, Charing Cross Road or 42nd Street, the longest streets, desire that never ends, familiar and inexplicable, wearing cosmetic light a fool could penetrate. She presses you with her hard ornaments, arcades, late movie shows, the piled lit windows of surplus stores. Here she is loveliest, extreme, material, and the work of man. Can't find this next point. Oh, thoughts on unpacking. I think this probably explains itself. Am I going over time? Thoughts on unpacking. Unpacking in the raw new rooms, I clear or try to clear a space for us, that we may cultivate an ease of moving here with no encumbrance near, in amplitude. But something hinders me. Where do these go, these knick-knacks I forgot? Gadgets we bought and kept, thinking perhaps they might be useful someday, and a lot of others that were not. Bent keys, Italian grammars, Mickey Mouse caps. And there are worse grotesques that, out of sight, unpacked, unlabeled, somehow followed too. The urgences we did not share, the spite of such and such a night, poses, mistakes, an unclean residue, that drift one after other till I find they have filled the space I carefully prepared. The sagging shapes I thought we left behind crawl out within the mind, seeming to sneer, this is the past you shared. I take a broom to them, but when I thrust round the diminished luggage, some roll back, surviving from my outbreak of disgust, as balls of hair and dust, made buoyant with a kind of fictive lack. I need your help with these. They rest unseen in furniture we know, and plot a changing to grey confusion of the space between. Now, as I sweep it clean, I realize that love is an arranging. I'll just read one more short poem. That will be a lot. It's called Vox Humana. Being without quality, I appear to you at first as an unkempt smudge, a blur, an indefinite haze, merely pricking the eyes, almost nothing. Yet you perceive me. I have been always most close when you had least resistance, falling asleep or in bars, during the unscheduled hours, though strangely without substance. I hang there and ominous. Aha! Sooner or later you will have to name me, and as you name, I shall focus, I shall become more precise. O Master, for you command in naming me, you prefer. I was for Alexander the certain victory, I was hemlock for Socrates, and in the dry night, Brutus, waking before Philippi, stopped me, crying out, Caesar. Or if you call me the blur that in fact I am, you shall yourself remain blurred, hanging like smoke indoors, for you bring to what you define now all there is ever of future.